After that introduction, I can hardly wait to hear myself speak. I think I recognise myself. It really is fun to be with you. I really enjoyed the last time I was here. We were looking at the literature of Philip Pullman and had a fairly free-ranging discussion about children's literature and worldviews and all the rest of it. So I really hope you'll ask lots of questions and get involved when there's a place to do that at the end. That really is milk and drink to me, so don't feel that, oh, you know, he's a visiting speaker, we must be polite, we mustn't say where we disagree or say anything dogmatic or all the rest of it. I love that sort of interaction. So I've been looking forward to this very much. I've got a few words of introduction about the passage we're looking at. So first of all, if you'd pick up the handout, that would be terrific. It's called Battle for the Mind, and you'll see in a moment why I've chosen that title. And I put in there two verses from the book of Romans, Paul the Apostle's letter to the Roman church. If you wouldn't mind turning to the letter to the Romans, it's on page 1141, 1141, towards the end of this Bible. There's about that much left of the Bible when you've got there. Just thought I'd put this particular, these two verses in context. And then having put them in context, you'll pretty much only need the sheet after that. So don't feel I'm going to take you on a paper chase. I do have a couple of cross-references, but you don't have to go with me if you don't want to. So our verses, chapter 12, verse 1 and, say, 1 and 2 say this: I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. What has gone before that he appeals to in the therefore, I appeal to you therefore by the mercies of God, in the light of God's mercies, is a really clear explanation of what the gospel is. And the earliest chapters of Romans, Paul says, we try all sorts of ways to be acceptable to God. We might just try and do our own thing. We suppress the real truth about God and worship ourselves and what we've made and think that's smart and that's intelligent and all the rest of it. That's frankly stupid. And we've come under God's wrath because it's self-evident that God is there by the creation, by our conscience, everything else. That's not a very smart thing to do. But then the religious person says, oh yes, well, I keep God's law. I'm a religious person. And Paul says to them, that's not very smart either, because if you appeal to God's law, you'll be judged by God's law, and you'll be found guilty, you'll be found lacking. And there's that wonderful verse in chapter 3 of Romans. It says, but now, there is a righteousness apart from the law that's been revealed. That is Jesus and his death, his passion, his resurrection. And by him, we can be acceptable to God. We can be made his friends, come into his family. So Paul is saying, I appeal to you, therefore, in the light of those mercies, I want you to give the whole of your lives, your bodies, as a living sacrifice. And what follows from verse 1 of chapter 12 is a fully orbed view of what it means to be a Christian in society. So in those early verses, verse 3, chapter 12, we see how we should treat fellow Christians in terms of love, of not being judgmental, about serving each other, whatever our gifts are. Verse 6, if they're prophecy, if they're service, if they're generosity, use the gifts we have to actually serve each other. And then we have a continuing explanation of the true marks of a Christian. Verse 9, abhor what is evil. Let love be genuine. Hold fast to what is good. And it goes through in very specific detail what it means in the light of God's mercy. This isn't how we get forgiven, but in the light of that. And chapter 13 goes on to tell us that we should pay our taxes and even obey a government. And the government in these days was Nero in Rome, you know, who loved to set fire to Christians and to light up the botanic gardens, put them on crosses and put pitch on them and light them. And Paul says, even with that sort of government is good. Obey it. Now, the mistake church can make is to go from Romans chapter 12, verse 1, and start there. and think, oh yeah, this is what being a Christian is. It's just leading a good life. It's just applying all these ethics to our own lives. That doesn't yield anything but disillusionment. The other mistake, particularly evangelicals can make, is properly to embrace those first 11 chapters, but not to see the ethical entailments of being a Christian. Or to go straight from those first 11 chapters into an application that begins at verse 3 of chapter 12, missing verse 2. And this is the substance of what I want to say. How do we present the whole of our bodies, the whole of our lives to God in terms of our relationship to each other, our families, society? Well, there's a really important starting point here in verse 2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So I've entitled this talk, Battle for the Mind. And notice the title is Battle for the Mind, not an exploration of brain function. I'm working on the assumption that we are self-aware creatures, moral agents, who can make choices about how we think and thus behave, but at the same time we are going to be affected by our environment. I don't know whether you've read the novel Lord Jim by Joseph Conrad, but it involves the disillusioned son of a clergyman, and he's trying to find himself in life. So picture this moment. Jim is on board a ship to Mecca, and there's a human cargo of 800 pilgrims. The ship hits an obstacle, and it begins to sink. And the 800 pilgrims are basically going to drown. And Jim finds himself sitting high up, looking down, and he notices that the officers have lowered a lifeboat, and they're quietly stealing away, deserting their charges, and getting into the lifeboat, captain, officers, together. Now, Jim looks down into the lifeboat and merely watches this cold-hearted desertion. What does he do? Does he jump into the lifeboat to save his own life, or does he stay to help the 800 passengers and risk his life? At first, Jim does nothing. He just watches. But then he jumps and finds himself in the safety of this lifeboat with the officers and the captain. Now, as it turns out, the Patna remains afloat and no lives are lost, but Jim is forever haunted by his act of cowardice, and he seeks anonymity and perpetual travel. His entire life is overshadowed by a question he can't answer, and it's simply this: did he jump, or was he pushed by events? And throughout the book, that is just the question that cannot be resolved. Is Jim a self-conscious, moral human being who can be held accountable for his actions or not? And throughout the book, he's stuck in this remorseless oscillation between seeing himself first as an actor and then as a spectator. And he's longing to actually find his own character. So what would you say to Jim? What would you say to Jim? Well, in many ways, it would depend on your view of humanness, what you actually think a person is. Do we have minds? Are we self-aware? Are we made in the image of God? Do we have identity and significance? Well, John Gray, he's a lecturer at the LSE, in his very disturbing book, Straw Dogs, but utterly compelling reading, he suggests that since secularists like him believe that human life is a cosmic accident, it's about time we grew up and shook off all the sentimental humanism that the Enlightenment never properly got rid of. Because was Enlightenment rejected God, it still kept man, humans, at the center of the universe. And that was kind of an old-fashioned superstition that the church had left them. They didn't quite break free from that. And he says this, and there's a quote here from him: we act in the belief that we are all of one piece, but we are able to cope with things only because we are a succession of fragments. We cannot shake off the sense that we are endearing selves, and yet we know we are not. So according to Gray, Jim's quest is hopeless. There's no integrated self he can discover and hold accountable for his actions. There's no mind that can be transformed, can be renewed. And Gray concludes, and I quote, "Lord Jim can never know why he jumped. That is his fate. As a result, he can never start his life afresh with a clean slate." So in this battle for the mind, just in terms of establishing who we are, that we actually have a mind, that there is a self, an integrated self. Gray and others are telling us to accept that everything you do, everything you aspire to do, is all about how your brain is hardwired. And that was predetermined half a second before the Big Bang. And there's no escaping that. And he suggests that people like Richard Dawkins are weenies. They haven't been logical in actually living up to the consequences of their own arguments. And of course, this whole theme of mechanical predetermination, it has informed lots of cult films like the Matrix trilogy. Well, the Bible has a wonderfully, radically different view of humans. That is, all of us here, however we feel about ourselves, are significant because we're made in God's image. It's an image marred by our rebellion, but an image that God is committed to restoring through sending Christ into the world, showing his mercies, a way of rescue there, but also providing a means by which we can be transformed and renewed back into the people we were made to be, to think God's thoughts after him, at the end of verse 3, to discern the right way to live, to have God's instincts, God's thoughts about how we live. And the reader is asked to cooperate in this process of transformation and renewal. According to Scripture, we're all, from God's perspective, dysfunctional in all sorts of ways. There's not a single area in our lives that hasn't been marred by sin. And so, Paul says this, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, and this is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." So let's look at both the positive and the negative. First of all, the negative: avoid conformity. Do not be conformed to the world. Now, I want to suggest there are two false moves we might make there. And the first one is legalism. I shan't turn to this passage, but Colossians 1:20-23 says there is a form of prescribing how we live in a way that avoids all contamination. Touch, don't touch this, don't taste that. It appears spiritual, it appears godly, but it has absolutely no capacity to restrain the things that actually destroy our lives. Garrison Keillor, in his late Woebegone days, has a wonderful parody of how evangelicals make this false move of legalism when it comes to worldliness. He says this, it's about musical instruments and the orchestra. He says, "To each person, God gives some talent, such as writing, just to name one. And to many persons, he's given musical talent, though not as many as think so. For the young Lutheran, the question must be, do I have a genuine God-given musical talent, or do I only seem gifted in comparison to other young Lutherans? If your talent is choir or organ, there's no problem. Choir members and organists can be sure their gift is from God, because who else apart from God would be interested? Just like nobody gets fat on celery, nobody goes into church music for the wrong motives. But for a Lutheran who feels led to play in an orchestra, the first question must be, are you kidding? An orchestra? In the Bible, we read about people singing and playing musical instruments, the harp, trumpet, lyre, but always in praise of the Lord, not for amusement. We do not read that our Lord himself ever played an instrument or enjoyed hearing others play theirs. The apostles did not attend concerts or go to dances. Are you sure this is what you want for your life? Do you know where you're getting into, what you're getting into? The next thing you'll know is you'll be into opera. Is that any place for a Christian? Don Juan, Mephistopheles, and Wagner, and all his pagan goddesses hooting and hollering? And the immorality. I mean, is anyone in opera married? You play in an orchestra, you're going to wind up in opera, and the next thing you know, you're going to be skipping Sunday mornings. Well, even if you steer clear of opera and stick to orchestral concerts, where are the Christian, the composers? Modern ones are existentialists, the Romantics were secular humanists, the 18th century was all rationalists, and the 17th century was Italians, except Bach, and you can't make a living playing Bach. You go into an orchestra, you're going to be devoting your life to a lot of music that sort of swirls around in spiritual mystery, searching for answers that people could find in the Bible if someone showed them where to look. And that is, I mean, that's a caricature, but I think a false move we often make when we're trying to not be conformed to the world is this kind of legalistic avoidance of the world. Another false move we make, I've suggested there, is asceticism. And if you wouldn't mind, you don't have to turn to this, I'll read it to you. 1 Timothy 4:1-4 tells us what asceticism is. It's a very unfriendly word. If anybody finds the page number, it might actually help me to find 1 Timothy 4. It's not always easy, is it? Thank you. 1195. I've just been saved a red face. 1195. So big four at the top of that right-hand page. And this is Paul warning a church in Ephesus against asceticism. We don't know what that is yet, but Paul will tell us. Now, the Spirit expressly says that in later times some will depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from foods that God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. The church has been intimidated for countless generations by, amongst other things, the cult of virginity. A French Christian in the Middle Ages called Yves of Chartres suggested in all seriousness that married couples should abstain from sex 5 days a week. This notion that, you know, as in Ephesus, this gift of marriage and sex and children is all just messy and not really for the really spiritual people. Anyway, Yves of Chartres says married couples should abstain from sex 5 days a week. And I quote, Thursdays to commemorate Christ's betrayal, Fridays to commemorate his death, Saturday to commemorate the Blessed Virgin Mary, and Sunday for the Lord's resurrection. I mean, you can only imagine what this week would have been like with Shrove Tuesday and Ash Wednesday. And it gives the gospel a bad name. Paul's very clear here. Verse 4, he says, everything, 1 Timothy 4:4, everything God created is good. It's to be received with thanksgiving. This world and friendship and marriage and food and drink. So that's false move number two. I think not being conformed is all about the mind, and Paul actually tells us it is. It's actually involving the renewal of the mind. And it must be the mind that is affected before lifestyle in any permanent way is going to be impacted. We can copy lifestyle, can't we? We can go to university, join the Christian Union, and copy a lifestyle that seems very pleasant and happy. But then, when we're out of university and we happen to be amongst a very different set of people, what is actually going to make us go against the flow? It's the dead fish, isn't it, that goes with the flow. It's only if you're alive, if you're spiritually alive, that you can swim against the currents. And I think the Bible wants us to be persuaded in our minds, which is why we must watch the battle for the mind. And I've suggested some areas where there is a real battle, and they're very media rich, and I hope you don't feel I go a little bit over the top about telly, because I make quite a few mentions of television, but I just think it is just a really easy area to illustrate from. But I don't want to get extreme views that we shouldn't have tellies and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, that's a warning. Now, I've suggested some areas where the battle for the mind rages most fiercely. First of all, they're experience versus innocence. If we're not to be conformed to the world, one of the things we'll have to realize is that the Bible values innocence. The world all the time wants us to have experience. In Genesis 3, we have the temptation saying, "Taste the fruit, you'll be like God. You will have the knowledge of right and wrong. You'll be able to decide what is right and what is wrong. Experience it, and then you choose." That's what it means to be like God, where you decide what's right and what's wrong. Whereas the Lord says, "Obey me, and you'll be truly human. You'll be in relationship with me. You'll actually bear my image, but not have my office." Well, the Bible really values innocence, even though essentially we've lost it. The media, of course, values exposure, experience, titillation. All must be probed and laid bare. The only sin is hypocrisy. The biggest crime John Major committed was not having an affair with Edwina Curry. It was insisting that we should get back to basics. So we're not even allowed to aspire after something innocent, better, good. Because, you know, that is not right. We're all grown-ups here. Let's just try things. Let's move with where things are going. Don't knock it if you haven't tried it. How can you criticize something you haven't seen? So that kind of reinforcement by the media of its high view on experiencing and seeing, however debauched. Because unless you do that, how can you make moral judgments? And of course, we've seen that with the Jerry Springer, the opera saga. Second area where we're tempted to be conformed, and a great means by which the media does make us conform, is this clutter and noise. This quote from Henry Thoreau. "We are in great haste to construct a magnetic telegraph from Maine to Texas, but Maine and Texas, it may be, have nothing important to communicate." I often feel that. I'm an addict to the radio in the mornings. And after a while, I think, why am I listening to this? They're just talking about absolutely nothing. They're doing it very nicely, very intelligently. The quote from God and Culture continues, "Every communication medium is designed to and empowered to create its own definition of discourse and will engage someone regardless of the content of the communication. The TV image offers more than 3 million dots per second, of which the viewer is only able to accept a few dozen. Every 3.5 seconds or less, and apparently it's normally less, the image is changed, demanding attention to the new image. So rapid new image by rapid new image, television seduces its viewers to keep watching telly, lest they miss something, regardless of the content." Well, Paul's actually saying the opposite. He's saying be active in not being conformed. Don't be passive. Telly wants to turn us into passive receptors of its values. And C.S. Lewis, in his wonderfully perverse way, exhorts us to take a break from the assault on our ears and our minds. And obviously you've got to slightly invert his advice. He says this in the Christian Reflections. "Avoid silence. Avoid solitude. Avoid any train of thought that leads off the beaten track. Concentrate on money, sex, status, health, and above all, on your own grievances." Jenny and I were talking about that this morning, how easy we find it to talk about ourselves and our own problems. "Keep the radio on. Live in a crowd. Use plenty of sedation. If you must read books, select them very carefully." And his advice on reading books, perversely, is always read the current books. Never read the old books, because they might challenge your way of thinking. "But you'd be safer to stick to the papers." I'm sure today he'd say the magazines. "You'll find the advertisements helpful, especially those with a sexy or a snobbish appeal." And Paul says, do not be conformed to the world. Don't allow the clutter and the noise just continually to suck you in, thinking, I might miss something. I have to read that article. I have to watch this on TV. I have to listen to that. Because it's actually dictating the pace at which we live, and also the sorts of things we're going to think about and value and talk about. The next bullet point on your handout is individualism versus real relationships. That's the top of page 2. Charles Colson decries the radical individualism in our culture and the extent to which the media have contributed to making us isolated, passive receptors. He describes much of the church as sofa loads of expressive individualists reclining in their living rooms, nibbling chocolates and reveling in TV-induced tears, testimony and titillation. And I've just put the comment there that, you know, it's hard, isn't it, in that context, even to aim at the sort of relationships Ephesians 5, 15 to chapter 6, 4 ask of us: harmonious communication, praise and thanks-filled interaction, joyful prayer, mutual submission to one another. So it does promote individualism, the whole media thing, particularly the telly. But also, uniquely, and I think I saw this, I think with the death of Diana, it encourages us to live vicariously through itself, through the media. See if I can find the right page. This is a super book. It's polemical, but it's great fun. Anybody read Abolition of Britain by Peter Hitchens? I don't agree with everything he says, but it's a terrifically thought-provoking book. And there's a great chapter called Suburbs of the Mind. And he talks about how we can live vicariously through TV. "It's clear to anyone with eyes in their head that Deirdre, is it Ratched on Rakeed? Rakeed. You can tell, I don't know much about soaps, can't you? Deirdre Rakeed is innocent and should be free. And that was a spokesman for the Prime Minister and First Lord of Her Majesty's Treasury, 31st of March, 1998. The leader of Her Majesty's opposition at the time fared little better when he said, "The whole nation is deeply concerned about Deirdre Rachid." And here's what Peter Hitchin wants to say about it. Deirdre Rachid did not exist. She was a fictional character in the television soap Coronation Street who'd been sent to a fictional prison by a fictional court for fictional crime. Everybody, including the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition, knew this. And yet they also knew that millions of people cared rather more fiercely about this figment than they did about much of the real world. Both of them would have felt it unwise to boycott the strange national festival of protest against Deirdre's harsh sentence. They were only following the example of most popular newspapers, which had for years treated the major soap opera series as if it were real, sometimes confusing their stars' television identities with their actual ones. Among the middle classes, where it's still slightly shameful to confess to watching TV soap operas, it was respectable to own up to an addiction to the radio soap opera The Archers. There was a genuine confusion in people's minds about which was real and which was not. The Prime Minister's own stepmother-in-law, if there can be such a thing, was the actress Pat Phoenix, far better known by her Coronation Street name, Elsie Tanner. She provided her services as a campaigner in his first hopeless by-election. You can see that Peter Hitchin's political sensibilities coming through, where she drew far bigger crowds than Tony Blair did. When a Coronation Street character was written out of the series and said to have retired to the remote village of Cartmel, thousands of street watchers made weekend pilgrimages to this beauty spot in search of their lost friend. Similarly, a group of satirists calling themselves the Archers Anarchists produced a quarterly bulletin whose theme is that there is no caste, that all the characters are real, they are only half-joking. And for some, especially schoolchildren returning to empty homes, mythical suburbs in Australia are more important than the real ones in Britain. And in the battle for the mind, I think the soap is a particularly powerful medium for encouraging us not to actually lead our own lives, but vicariously to enter other people's. But it's actually distorting. And we're picking up the values that other people display, especially if we've found them sympathetic. I think I mentioned last time about Friends. One of the reasons why Friends has had more of an impact on our kids, teenage kids, is because you get to know the characters over months and years. And therefore, when somebody like Joey, who sleeps with somebody else's bride the night before the wedding, and he's chastised for it, he says, "What do you mean? Are there rules?" And because everybody loves Joey, we're all thinking, "Yeah, why are we being so puritanical about this? We're all growing up here, etc., etc." And then I put here, and this is perhaps the major issue in the battle for the mind, redefining truth. Again, a nice perverse quote from C.S. Lewis. Bear in mind that when Screwtape, the senior devil, in advising his novice Wormwood, uses words like desirable, he, of course, is talking about something quite hideous and horrid. So you have to slightly invert things in your head to make sense of this. In advising his junior demon, who's trying to conform his subject, his human being, into the mindset of the world, this is the advice. "Think of your man as a series of concentric circles, his will being the innermost, his intellect coming next, and finally his fantasy. You can hardly hope at once to exclude from all the circles everything that smells of the enemy, which is of course God. But you must keep on shoving all the virtues outward till they are finally located in the circle of fantasy. And all the desirable qualities," that's of course all the horrid stuff, "inward into the will." I don't know whether you read the book Letters to Alice by Faye Weldon. She was writing, I think, to her niece and trying to give her a good kind of landscape of literature and how to build a world view from literature. And so she kind of painted a picture of a city, and she says dominating the city are the castles of Shakespeare and the King James Bible, you see. And then you get smaller settlements. And then you've got the red light district, which is pornography and violence and all the rest of it. But the closest thing to the red light district, which naturally leads into the red light district, according to Faye Weldon's picture, is fantasy. Because that is the place where you stop disciplining your mind.
you stop actively engaging with the issues and you just allow yourself just to flow and to just enter in. I'm not saying one should never watch fantasy, read fantasy, but if you let it dominate, Faye Weldon is convinced with young people it leads you to bad places. Now, we get much of our news, which of course is not very much news, it's more comment than the news, and a significant percentage of our convictions about truth and error from the media, and right and wrong are now moving targets. And again, I just want to share a little bit from Peter Hitchens' view of Grange Hill. Grange Hill began in 1978 and must have formed the early worldview of millions of schoolchildren. The setting is London outskirts, more east than west, multicultural, multiracial, and with inmates described as streetwise, the modern word for sly and knowing. From the moment it began, it was attacked by the sort of people TV programmers want to be attacked by. Mary Whitehouse quickly condemned it for undermining teachers' authority, which of course it did. In 1980, an official of the National Association of Schoolmasters, then a far more conservative organisation than its current incarnation, said, and I quote, "The teachers come out as buffoons, and all we see are strikes and sit-ins, larceny and violence." The Daily Telegraph said that the programme encouraged bad manners and discouraged scholarship. It was also disliked for making estuary English the universal classless patois of southern England, and it made it widely fashionable. None of these criticisms, of course, had the slightest effect. The ratings were good. Television's regulators are powerless against the mere spreading of attitudes, even though those attitudes ultimately make it possible for program makers to go on to break important barriers against bad language, violence, and sexual display. And I've just put in that kind of last big block of stuff that, according to Ben Stein in his work, The View from Sunset Boulevard, which is featured in a book called God and Culture, I've got somewhere in my bag if you want to have a look at it, he suggests that there's an uncanny homogeneity in media values, and amongst the values that he says are just right throughout Hollywood films and television are these. And these are just kind of formulaic. High-level police are bungling and corrupt, but a few rare heroes at lower levels do exist. I'm sure if we just took time, we could all immediately come up pretty much with films that showed this. Responsibility for crime is seldom placed on the criminal and is more commonly placed on society or the evils in society. Church ministers are sinister, hypocritical, or benignly harmless but irrelevant figures. Sexual activity is beautiful, desirable, morally neutral, and acceptable with few, if any, restraints. Religion is a non-issue in life and is essentially irrelevant. I want to show you just a quick clip from the film The Last Supper. I don't know whether you've seen it. Anybody seen The Last Supper? It's not a particularly new film. It's about 4 years old or so. And you've got a group of postgrad students who basically sign off on all these values. They hate the Christian worldview big time. And they accidentally kill someone who happens to be attacking their worldview and attacking them physically. They don't mean to kill him, but he dies. Then one of them says, "Haven't we done the world a service? We've killed somebody who has views that are unworthy. Why don't we regularly have a Friday night supper," it's Friday or Saturday night supper, "where we invite someone we think will have a worldview different to ours, and if they show themselves totally unworthy of our hospitality, on the signal, shall we have dessert or shall we have pudding, we'll pour them pudding wine, dessert wine, which will have poison in it, and we'll kill them." And this is the film slightly loses its way because it ends up killing too many people. But this is the first visitor who is a minister. And he exhibits all these qualities. That is, benignly harmless but irrelevant. You think that's what he's going to be at the beginning. But watch and you'll see what the film does with him. So he's been invited to supper. He's been invited to talk to this group of postgrads, and obviously they're thinking, do we agree with his worldview? Is it permissible? Now, how do we do this? it's very hard, isn't it, not to be conformed. That is actually quite a subtle film. It's not subtle as much, it just ends up killing loads of people, but there's a beautiful twist at the end, but you actually realise that the liberals have, of course, become totally illiberal, because they decide who lives and who dies. If anybody's view doesn't match theirs, and they are deemed to be unworthy, then they must be wiped off the face of the planet. So it's very playful, but along the way, it's quite obvious what are the virtuous views and what are the immoral views and all the rest of it. So how do we watch film? How do we watch media? We can discuss this both in the formal time and afterwards if you guys are able to hang around. How do we watch films critically? Well, one of the things I think it's good to do is just to reflect on film. Watch it, enjoy it. I'm not saying don't enjoy films. We love film, Ruth and I. But do reflect on it. Have a conversation about it afterwards. Ruth and I, 2 weeks ago, watched the film House of Sand and Fog. Anybody seen that? Ben Kingsley. And it appears an immensely moral film. In fact, I was just saying to Ruth, having watched it, what a fantastically moral film that was. You had one police officer who basically was married, had young kids, slightly fancied someone whose home he was helping to repossess. He was, you know, the strong arm of the law, helping the bailiffs come in. And you just saw how disastrous his early flirtations were with this person. And it led to quite a lot of people losing their lives and broke up all sorts of relationships and all the rest of it. And so the film, from beginning to end, tells you this is utterly dysfunctional, this is destructive. If you don't honour your marriage vows, if you flirt with this sort of danger, you'll ruin everybody's lives. But what totally missed my radar was the fact that when Ben Kingsley, sorry if I'm spoiling this for you, but when something terribly tragic happens in his life, he thinks the only sensible thing is for him to poison his wife in a way that she doesn't realise she's being poisoned, and to kill himself. And the way and that, you may think, well, how could that miss your radar? I mean, that's just so, oh, that's murder, and that's, you watch the film, and it just seems a very compassionate, understandable thing to do. Very hard not to be conformed. And Of Mice and Men, both the book and the film, does exactly the same thing on the whole euthanasia thing. So when the euthanasia bill comes up, which it's going to do, there's big debate, as you know now, in the medical fraternity, when it comes up, we will have been conditioned by that sort of viewing over many, many, many years. Do not be conformed, but be transformed. I'm not doing very well on time, am I? We've got to finish at 5:30, yes? Yeah. Okay, sorry, I'm not being very disciplined on this. Let's very quickly then look at what it means to be transformed. Transformed to what? What are our models? Very hard to live without models. Well, if in essence we are just merely a random bunch of replicating DNA, into what are we being renewed? Well, the Bible unashamedly locates our significance and our identity in the fact that we're made in God's image. We've fallen from it, but we need to be restored back to it. And if in your own time you turn to Genesis 1, 26 and 27, you see the first humans made in God's image. They're distinct from the other animals in that respect. And we're, in large measure, given a picture of what real humanness is like. Obviously, the express image of God is Christ, and we're going to be made like Christ. But the nearest to that, amongst normal human beings, is Adam and Eve. What does real humanness look like? What is this human identity, this image of God? Well, I put 5 words there that give you a good start. We're linguistic creatures. Adam, when given Eve as his wife, composed a poem. This is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. To give it its modern parlance, it's, whoa, she's all right. He was very pleased and was able to write a poem that was apparently perfect Hebraic parallelism. How Adam knew that, I really don't know. They were intelligent. Adam and Eve were asked to classify, or Adam was, all the species of animal and plants and find suitable names. They were creative, not just classifying plants and animals, but designing and ordering the garden. They were relational. Adam and Eve were not only gregarious with each other, but uniquely had a relationship with God. They walked with God and had friendship with him and conversed with him. And they were moral. God set the shape of the relationship. It wasn't an equal one. They couldn't decide what was right and wrong. That wasn't their knowledge. That was God's. But they were moral agents. They could make moral choices. And of course they made a disastrous wrong choice. Just as they fell by their own choice, we can say that Jim fell into that lifeboat out of choice. We choose in large measure to conform or actively to be transformed.
At this point, there is a short gap of just a few seconds in the original recording.
What does God look like? It's linguistic, intelligent, creative, relational, and moral, for starters. Now, if all that's true for Adam and Eve, how does that help us in what Paul says needs to be our spiritual worship, where we offer our bodies, the whole of ourselves, as a living sacrifice? Well, how did Adam and Eve manage to worship God? How did they offer spiritual worship? They had no Bible, no church, no hymn books. Were they poor, destitute spiritual creatures? No. The whole of their lives, the whole of what they were, whether they were digging the garden, whether they were obviously walking with the Lord in the garden or with each other or doing their work, everything they did, they offered the whole of their lives as a living sacrifice. They didn't just clock in, oh, I'm doing worship now, now I'm in church singing a song, or I'm doing worship now, now I'm walking with God. No, the whole of their lives was offered to God. Now, I find that immensely liberating, that life doesn't easily divide into secular and sacred, into spiritual and physical. All you do Monday to Saturday with your children, with your husbands, with your friends, is to be acceptable spiritual worship. It's to offer that in a way that's acceptable to God. And it will only be acceptable if we're not conformed in the way we do our relationships to our children, the way we talk to them, the way we talk to each other, the way we talk to our husbands, etc. It will only be acceptable worship if we are not conformed, but allow ourselves to be transformed, to be renewed. So whilst it's liberating that there isn't a single area of our lives that can't be offered to God in worship, it's also challenging because there isn't a single area that doesn't need to be transformed, that hasn't been affected by sin. So in view of God's mercies, let me sum up now. Let's offer the whole of what we are to God as an acceptable sacrifice. We are children of the living God. We don't just give in to circumstances. We don't just say we're hardwired brute beasts. Because if we actively don't allow ourselves to be conformed, but cooperate with the Lord in the process of renewal, thinking Christianly about relationship, about ambition, money, what we value, how we bring up our kids. If we do that, then we will gradually be transformed, and then we'll have this wonderful progress in knowing what God's will is, thinking God's thoughts after Him, being more in tune with the way God wants us to do relationship, to do ambition, to do money, more in tune with that than we are with the world's. One thing I'd encourage you to do when you get home is look in the mirror, and with all your follies and weaknesses, realize you're looking at an eternal masterpiece. You are, all of us here, we are made in God's image. So if any of us feel low about ourselves for reasons of nurture or nature, or having lots of children, and I know all about that, and always beating ourselves up, aren't we, that we didn't spend enough time with this one, or we were too harsh on that one, and all the rest of it. If your life at times just seems a little bit absurd, and just goes round in circles, realize you are of unimaginable intrinsic worth to God. Could you imagine somebody discovering a stained and tattered Rembrandt and chucking it in the bin? Well, you are a masterpiece of creation that is consigned for restoration, for renewal and glory. Lord Jim could have had his slate wiped clean. But of course, only through a relationship with Christ. Only from what he could have read in those first 11 chapters of Romans. Uniquely through God coming into our planet, showing us how much he loves us and how much he is offended by our sin and angry at it. Our slate could have been wiped clean, but once it is, once we've come through Christ, we enter into a relationship with the one who made us, who is committed to us becoming the people we were made to be.
And so whatever we're doing this week, we need to cooperate in the process of renewal and transformation. Whether that work is manual, intellectual, paid or unpaid, whether we're at home or at school, wherever, we have to worship the Lord in all we do. Make all we do a living sacrifice acceptable to Him. And then, if we do it in a way that's acceptable to Him and not to the world, we will think His thoughts after Him. We will be guided. We will know the way we should increasingly go. Right. I've quickly wrapped that up. Over to you. Questions? Comments? Sorry if it was a little bit rushed at the end, but hopefully you stayed with that. Oh, thank you. It should be, because Colossians 1 is extolling the virtues of Christ, the supreme firstborn of creation. Thank you very much. Okay. Everybody hear the question? Telly. You know, there are lots of practical challenges. How do you balance the notion of possibly having one, the benefits, not having one, and if you have one, how do you check what they watch? And, you know, practically, you know, what are people's views on that? Now, I have to confess, I took the easy way out when I got married. We just didn't get a telly and I've never had one. So I'm afraid I'm not going to be much help to you. So people who do live with a telly, help us out. Yeah, sure. One of the things we touched upon last time is you just cannot keep false ideas out, because they will come through. When I wasn't being flippant when I said I took the easy way out, I did. And I'm not saying it was the right thing to do. We watch lots of film. We've got a video monitor and we watch lots of films. And they do watch things that, you know, will give a worldview that we're not happy with. But the thing is, they will pick up those things. So we have to give them the tools for engaging with that. And kids are actually quite savvy. They know that people are trying to sell them products. They know that people are trying to steer them to one side. Certainly when it's in the form of one program. But I do think the soap issue is something slightly more potent and dangerous because of the vicarious nature of living their lives through these characters over months and years. So I think the most hideous thing on telly is the soaps. I'd rather my kids watch Life of Brian or whatever. It's something that's really against Christianity, and we could, or Philip Pullman, we could then deconstruct it and just get this insidious drip, drip, drip over months and years. So that, I have to say, that's my big bugbear. I think it's a really hard one. I think probably in most cases it's not appropriate not to have a telly. It's been okay for our kids. If they were getting really stigmatized for it and all the rest of it, we would have done it. And I don't particularly advise people not to. I'm not a real crusader for that. And I think that's a really important point. Another subject, or are we still on this? How do we equip our kids without TV? Well, the funny thing is, of course, they do see some TV, in as much as, you know, every now and then they're either on a, you know, a camp, or at a friend's house, and their friends talk about it and all the rest of it. So they are aware. Sometimes, believe it or not, in church, they'll watch an episode of Friends as a central perk, as they call it, and all the rest of it. So they are aware, and knowing that they don't have a TV, you know, as somebody was saying earlier, their friends will tell them about it and engage with them. But we do watch film. We go to the cinema quite a bit. We've got this video monitor. In fact, I borrowed a projector from work, and we now watch films on the wall. So, you know, we're totally, you know, saturated now in image. Well, it's this huge, great thing. I mean, I found Ashley when he was 4, when we didn't have a telly, sort of watching the loop monitor in Tesco, you know, advertising Cut-O-Matic. You know, he was so visually deprived. So we watch film, and we talk about the stuff they're reading and some of the ideas in the newspapers and politics. And our eldest two read The Week. It's a weekly summary of the news and all the rest of it. And I'm as you can tell, I'm quite a vocal person. Will always sound off about what I think of the government and all the rest of it. So there's an atmosphere where it's okay to, you know, sort of say what you think about stuff and to lay it on the line. And we're not precious about views, so people can air their views. So I think having a context over meals and all the rest of it where you can talk about what's going on is really important. But I'm not saying we do it particularly well, but that's what we try to do. Yeah.
What, practical stuff?
Well, I think the biggest thing that helped Ruth was reading a couple of books by Susan Schaefer McCauley. And one of them was books, I think it's her, she certainly is involved in the distribution of it, Books Children Read or Books Children Love. Can anybody help me with the title? Ruth has probably given titles to people here. And helping children formulate a worldview, if that title's right, I think it's Books Children Read. But I'll get the title. And it helps you deliberately steer your kids towards books that will give them heroes and kind of categories and values that will be really useful. So not just Christian books. So, for example, take Kenneth Graham, Wind in the Willows. He's an out-and-out pagan, worship the trees and all the rest of it, away with the fairies. But he celebrated loyalty, friendship, honesty, was against snobbery, with his wonderful character Badger, who didn't bother with the conventions of society. And when his late night guests were talking with their mouths open, he didn't mind because they were happy and they were guessing. So, literature that celebrates the virtues that God celebrates in terms of what's important, and deliberately feeding stuff in to kids. So that was just a really seminal book for her. I don't know. I must admit, I do find reading stuff like this very stimulating, just making me not just go with the flow. God and Culture, I mentioned, which has a chapter on looking at the media. C.S. Lewis constantly asks us to evaluate whether we are just being sucked along. So The Abolition of Man, I think, is particularly brilliant for Lewis. Yeah, there is. It's a good point. The Bible is materialistic. God made us as humans. He made us with appetites, proper appetites. And the very baseline things that we have to do, like eat and sleep and reproduce, he made that to be pleasurable. That's the sort of God he is. And Christians will be given resurrection bodies that are like Christ. And Christ, ate fish on the beach. Digestion is spiritual. It's just a wonderful thought. We won't be some sort of, wispy, bodiless, spirit in heaven, but we'll have real bodies. And we can embrace and be embraced. We can eat, we can drink, we can have conversations, see each other's facial expressions. So the Bible celebrates the physical. Everything God made is good, and it's to be received with thanksgiving. But of course, those appetites can be abused. Sex is good, but in its right context. Fire is good, but in the fireplace, not in your lap. Sex is good in the context of a committed marriage of one man with one woman for life. And so there's a sense in which we receive the gift in the spirit, in the context in which it was given, and embrace it. But we enjoy it in the context of gratitude to the giver, rather than thinking, right, I'm going to get as much of this gift as possible. But it's to be received with thanksgiving. And that's the thing, rather than be received greedily, and I'm going to grasp it, I'm going to hold on to it, and I'll just get as much of this as I can. And I won't actually see that it's all pointing to a giver who provides us with all good things. So it is a tension, but it is a false move to avoid the good gifts he's given us. And it's also a false move just to say, well, I can do what I like, and just follow appetite as if there's no such thing as truth and sobriety and conviction and discipline, because all those things are there. And in a fallen world, you need the balance. Shall I pray?
Yes.
Would that be good? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we do thank you for the goodness of the gospel. Thank you that it's not an arbitrary list of things we must do, hoops we must jump through in order to win your favor, but the very gospel we're given meets us at our point of need, rescues us, and then asks us to live in a way that's utterly consistent with your character, who you are and who you're making us to be and who we'll be in heaven. Thank you for that. Thank you for the goodness of it. Thank you for the fact that we can trust that gospel, and actually when we look at it closely, we see how attractive it is. Please motivate us even today to want to be renewed and transformed, to be made back into that image that was marred and fallen. And pray that you'd help us to help each other as a community here, to give each other good practical help as to how we can avoid conformity and move inch by inch, perhaps millimetre by millimetre, towards that renewal and that transformation that you're committed to in us. Thank you for the gospel, and thank you for each other and our families. In Jesus' name, amen.